Welcome to this week's edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. So much to talk about this week, including a discussion of anti-Semitism in Great Britain. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, whenever you're listening to us. This is the Third Opinion Podcast, and on WKDW, two Jews, three opinions. I'm one of the two Jews, Mike Deason.
I'm the other, Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are with us today, whenever you're listening to us. A lot of stuff going on, Lorene.
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, Happy New Year, everybody.
That's right.
it's a wonderful new year. And Mike and I are going to take you around the globe today with never a shortage of our favorite stories, what's going on in the Jewish world. I got to say, because there's a lot of negative stuff that goes on. But one of my favorite stories this week, which is like it's a sports related. So the NBA, the Washington Wizards, so the NBA team, Washington Wizards, are going to host a Jewish Heritage Night with Israeli performances and a special Wizrael jersey for the Wizards. So instead of saying Wizards, they'll say Wizrael. And then with yarmulkes, the head coverings for those of you who don't know what the kippah is. But it's really going to be exciting. So they're going to be doing this while they're playing the Oklahoma City Thunder on January 11th. I was so amazed by this. It's going to take place at the Capital One Arena in Washington, D.C.
There's a big Jewish community in Washington. I'd like to see some of the other cities with big Jewish communities, Chicago, obviously, New York, Los Angeles. That would be a nice thing to do in various Jewish communities throughout the country, I think.
Well, they have Avdija. So Avdija, who is the highest ever NBA draft pick from Israel and currently the only Israeli in the NBA plays for them. And so the other thing is really interesting about them. I guess he just got people really excited about the NBA in Israel. So the Washington Wizards is also the first team to actually have an entire Hebrew Instagram site and Twitter site. So they tweet in Hebrew, which is just like unbelievable for all the followers of the Washington Wizards. So I just thought that was just like a nice little story to start the new year off.
And there's another basketball story you sent me.
Yes.
With Amari Stoudemire.
Stoudemire.
Yeah, what did I say? Stoudemire. Yes, I'm spacing out. Yeah, Stoudemire, who converted to Judaism and is now ready to get remarried, and he's gonna get a Jewish divorce, right? He was married before, correct?
He was. So I think he already is. Where I think he's looking for a shidduch. So for those of you who don't know, like shidduch, a matchmaker to help him find a nice Jewish girl. Is definitely interested in moving back to Israel because he made Aliyah. He became he converted Judaism, became an Israeli citizen. And so for those of you who are interested, you can learn a little bit more about Stoudemire because there's actually like a documentary on him, on his journey from the NBA to Orthodox Judaism on one of the recent HBO episodes, Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. But really cool. So for those of you who might be interested, I mean, look, he's on the market. He's looking for a shot. Yeah. So the ladies out there who are looking, he might be your match.
Okay, here's something you may not know, but of interest to the people who are listening in the Tampa Bay area. He was born and grew up in Lake Wales, Florida, which is about, 45 minutes to an hour outside of Tampa. It's sort of between Tampa and Orlando. He went to Lake Wales High School. Yeah. So he is a Florida native. If he was here, he might be listening to our show. He could still listen to it anywhere.
Right? I never would have thought that. But that's so cool that he went to, that he's a local to us here. And it's so funny because you never really hear about it locally, but he is kind of like a little hometown hero. So we should. I'm surprised that I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Little known facts. I'm a compendium of useless information that I come up with all the time. There have been some really disturbing anti-Semitic incidents this week that really, really... I don't even know where to start.
Wait, which one got you the most? Because I got one that really was just bizarre. It was like bizarro.
How about the Utah tech
there you go.
Guru,
yes.
David Bateman, who was asked to resign and did eventually because he blamed COVID on the Jews.
Right. So he was the he's the founder of Entrada, the software firm, and was asked to resign and did. But it's so weird. And of course, the company, just so for those of you who are investing in Entrada, they came out and they renounced everything that he said. But he was on social media and he made this quote, and it says, quote, "For 300 years, the Jews have been trying to infiltrate the Catholic Church and place a Jew covertly at the top." Bateman wrote, quote, "It happened in 2013 with Pope Francis. I believe the pandemic and systematic extermination of billions of people will lead to an effort to consolidate all countries in the world under a single flag with totalitarian rule," end quote. And he did. And then he went on and he blamed the COVID-19 and its vaccines are the work of the Jews. And which he claimed was attacking reproductive systems and eroding natural immunity. I mean, I don't even know, like, what type of conspiracy theories you're listening to on social media to even, like, how do you, like, such a brilliant man.
Can be
brilliant.
So off. Yeah, absolutely.
So off face, like, bizarro world.
Okay, and then it's crazy. Then how about the former Dutch Prime Minister, Dries Van Agt, I think is how you say it, who said Israeli soldiers were poisoning Palestinians.
And what was so crazy, because, like, even the humanitarian organization, Basila M, that, like, hates Israel, is, like, very anti-Semitic, and anti-Israel is like, we've never even heard of that, so we don't even know what he's talking about. So I'm just saying, like, this is, like, he did a public documentary where he was talking about these, and, like, literally being emotional, talking about all these horrific things that Israelis were doing to these, to these Palestinians, and just awful stuff of it. The guy is known, I mean, he's been known, you know, since the early 70s of being a very open anti-Semite, open anti-Israel, you know, and, you know, is accused, and by the way, has stood on a public stage, you know, and has spoken jointly with leaders from Hamas. I mean, it's not like, it's not like he's a friend of Israel. It's not, you know, that's somebody who should go, when you hear him speak. But yeah. It's sad that it comes from Dutch, from the Netherlands, with the Netherlands, you know, going back 600 years was such it was a place of refuge for many Jews trying to flee the Inquisition. And we know that many Jews in the Netherlands unfortunately lost their lives during the Holocaust. But very sad to see that here, you know,
it really was. And then you sent me one that was amazing to me. Someone had ordered an IDF sweatshirt, and packed within the sweatshirt were F-bombs about Israel.
Someone from Amazon decided to write a special note on this. So for those of you, I don't know if we got to the story last week, but there was a young man, a college age student in New York, who's wearing an IDF, Israeli Defense Forces sweatshirt. You know, he's not Israeli. He's just a New York Jew and, you know, supports the IDF and supports Israel's right to defend himself, and was physically attacked. He was beaten. It was anti-Semitic attack. He got beaten up for wearing a sweatshirt. And so there was a whole solidarity campaign on social media and different elected officials and others coming out and, you know, putting on their sweatshirts or IDF sweatshirts and proudly supporting him and supporting the IDF. So this young man, Alexander Ginden, purchased an IDF sweatshirt from Amazon, had it delivered to his house, and it said, and somebody from Amazon decided to write a personal note in his package that said, "F your white supremacy nation." And that's disturbing. So, you know, it's just, I mean, he reached out to Amazon for customer service and they acknowledged that this was a horrible thing that should have happened, but they didn't have any way of it.
It's hard to with all the packages that Amazon just sends to my house.
I mean, seriously, right? How do you find the person who packaged that?
That's right. But it just blew me away. And then what about the one about don't hire Shabbat observant Jews
that was at the university. What was that? That was the the British university.
Yeah,
no, the Canadian university.
The Canadian university. Yeah.
It was in their diversity training.
Don't hire Shabbat oriented Jews, those observant Jews, because it will screw up your ability to bring them in if you need work on the weekends.
I mean, it was like so crazy. It's like, so in their they had a diversity training, and of course the university said, oh, this diversity training isn't associated with us, has nothing to do with us, we don't you know, condone this, whatever. I mean, you know, we've brought you countless stories from Canada.
We certainly have. Hey, we lost a couple of people this week of note in the Jewish community. Sarah Jaffe, no relation, I assume.
No relation.
but she was the founder of Preservation Hall in New Orleans, one of the best jazz places. Have you ever been there?
I don't know if I've been to several places.
They had
old
timey jazz with trombones and saxophones, and just one of the coolest places in New Orleans. She had been the proprietor and founder of it for, geez, I don't know how many years, 60 years, something like that, because I've been there several times years ago and then more recently. So, yeah, she passed away this week. And then Peter Bogdanovich, I didn't realize this. His mom was Jewish. Did you know that?
Who's he?
Peter Bogdanovich was the Academy Award-winning director. The Last Picture Show was his biggest. He won an Oscar for it. He was in
The Last Picture Show.
Yeah, The Last Picture Show. It starred Sybil Shepherd. It's worth looking at if you've never seen it. Let me tell you, as long as we're talking about Sybil Shepherd, I have got a great story about Sybil Shepherd. Years ago,
I love Sybil. Okay. She's beautiful.
I do too. Years ago, when I was working in Norfolk, Virginia, I was anchoring a new newscast that was sort of like the Today Show. We did news and we talked about the things and had guests. Well, Sybil Shepherd was in town. There was a dinner theater that brought stars in. And so she comes to do our show. And in this show, in my show, whenever there were little kids on, the little boys, I'd make them shake my hand. And the little girls, I'd say, kiss me on the side of the cheek. You know, it was sort of a goofy little bit. Anyway, she was on one day when there were little kids on. She's the last guest. And we're talking and we're finishing up the segment. She said, well, I saw what you did with the little girls there. Aren't you going to ask me to give you a kiss? And I said, well, yeah, sure. So I expected her to put a little kiss on my cheek. She gets up and just plants her lips on mine, almost knocks over the chair, and gives me the biggest kiss in the world. It was terrific. And then we had her on at the end of the run. And she comes back on the show again. We do the interview. We finish it. And I thank her. And she says, Mike, you know what time it is. And she gives me another big kiss right on the lips. So that's my Sybil Shepherd story, you know. Loreen, did we lose you? Hang on a second.
Oh, wait, I'm here. I love Sybil. She's so beautiful. I'm sorry. I went on mute because I had a sneeze. So I forgot to come back on.
Anyway.
That's
my Sybil Shepherd story.
I think another one about, so let's go back to like Hollywood and celebrities. So, you know, for those of you who are not aware, it's Sydney, Australia. I love Australia, but so BDS, you know, they're always running these campaigns to get, you know, artists to boycott any event where Israel's involved around the world. And so there was this latest effort to get musicians and dancers and artists to boycott a festival that's happening in Sydney right now. There's over 120 artists, dancers, singers, et cetera, performing. Apparently 30 acts so far have canceled because Australia and the organization putting together this music and arts festival has signed a $20,000 sponsorship agreement with the Israeli embassy in Israel, because they're going to put on a performance by Decadence, which apparently is a piece by an acclaimed Israeli choreographer, Ohad Nahrin. So because they had given this $20,000 scholarship to the Israeli embassy to support this beautiful dance performance, all these organizations and artists, whatever, are dropping out. And I have to respect Gene Simmons of KISS and Nancy Spielberg and so many other artists who are part of the nonprofit group Creative Community for Peace, which stands up against the boycott. They penned a public letter, in essence, condemning these people that were boycotting it, calling it an affront to both Palestinians and Israelis who are working to advance peace through compromise, exchange, and mutual recognition. And then it went on to say that the boycott turns the festival from an opportunity for unity into a weapon of division. And so, you know, I applaud the American artists and others.
Weren't there 120 artists, yeah, something like that, that said this is crazy?
Yes.
Signed the petition,
yes,
or something, said this,
exactly,
this is crazy. Hey, you know, we like to do a lot of things looking back and getting some Jewish culture and understanding of how life was for Jews before we were around. And I came across an interesting piece about life in a shtetl, about how Jews were just forced to live together in places that maybe were not exactly ideal, and they couldn't go anyplace else. And I think it's very important for us to remember, as we're living, most of us, good lives and are blessed with,
right,
what we have. But we forget what our forefathers and ancestors had lived through. And I wanted to take a listen to this piece.
Which, by the way, we should say, you know, if I were a rich man, it's not like Fiddler on the Roof, you know, it was a musical, there was wonderful, cheerful, and sad at the end, but, you know,
yeah,
as Mike said, there's a reality, and it was very bleak for many Jews. Very
bleak, not Fiddler on the Roof at all. Let's take a listen.
Exactly.
During the 18th century, the Jews of Russia were lucky to be spared from the worst horrors of Europe. No inquisitions, crusades, or expulsions. However, they were restricted to a single tract of land, the Pale of Settlement, and forced to live in often poor villages called shtetls. These unique Jewish communities created innovations that revolutionized Jewish thought and education until a reign of terror brought it all to an end. Beginning in 1772, Russia started annexing this area, and with it came an influx of Jewish merchants. Local merchants already living there felt threatened, and they accused these new merchants, the Jews, of being frauds and liars. In 1791, Catherine the Great responded by confining the entire Jewish population to a 1 million square kilometer tract, the Pale of Settlement. That may seem spacious, but within it, Jews were restricted from settling in good rural areas, villages, almost the entire northern province, and plenty of cities. They were almost entirely confined to shtetls. On top of the restrictions, the region became a magnet for waves of anti-Semitic violence. The stereotypical Yiddish-speaking farmer, tailor, shoemaker, old world image depicted in Fiddler on the Roof and Yentl was a fairly accurate portrayal of the shtetl existence. Each shtetl had their own schools, kosher butchers, synagogues, and ritual baths. From around 1790 to 1840, there was a sort of golden age, a thriving time economically, communally, and religiously. While every Pale community was different, they all shared rampant poverty. The population relying on welfare almost never dipped below 14% and reached as high as an estimated 33%. Tzedakah, charity, remained an unnegotiable priority. No matter how desperate things got, almost no one starved to death. The poor had health care, students had clothing, brides had dowries, and orphans received an education. Though the shtetl was not materially blessed, it flourished spiritually. Towards the end of the 1700s, the growth of the Hasidic movement emerged and became the genesis of dynasties that are still prevalent today. As the rulers changed, so did the Jews' situation, sometimes for the better. In 1804, for instance, Jewish farmers and manufacturers gained the right to send their children to Russian schools. But in 1825, a xenophobic tyrant, Nicholas I, began mandatory military conscription. Though a similar system was started 100 years earlier, Nicholas kicked things up a notch by pulling children as young as 10 from their homes to be educated in military schools and to eventually serve in the Russian army for 25 years. This threatened the transmission of Jewish religion, culture, and identity to the next generation. The very fabric of Jewish life was in jeopardy. Jewish leaders were forced to fill quotas of how many boys to send from each community, a devastating dilemma. The Jews who were more well off bribed their way out of conscription, but the vast majority had far fewer options. Some even resorted to such measures as cutting off their sons' right index fingers. No trigger finger meant no gunfire, which hopefully meant an exemption from service, a possible death sentence. Many of those that didn't die in warfare cracked under the pressure and converted to Christianity or simply lost their Jewish identity altogether. This system lasted for about 30 years until around 1856, when a more compassionate czar widened the pale of settlement and allowed Jews to practice medicine, crafts, and trade. During this era, Rabbi Chaim ben Isaac, known as Chaim of Volozhin, revolutionized Jewish education with the modern yeshiva. With the goal of making Torah education available to any Jew, he guaranteed tuition support and a revolutionary curriculum. Russian authorities opposed the yeshiva system, demanding that it provide secular education and teach in Russian, not Yiddish. After years of struggle, they closed their doors rather than cave to the demands, but not before becoming the international model for the modern yeshiva. This is also when the Musar movement began, which prioritized fundamental character development like kindness and fostering a fulfilling relationship with God. This movement ran parallel to the more law-focused traditional Talmudic study of the time. It is also the basis of many moral teachings in Judaism today. But for each step forward, there was always pushback with subsequent shifts in power. Alexander III, who assumed the throne in 1881, blamed his father's assassination on the Jews. This was, unsurprisingly, a complete fabrication. Nevertheless, the accusation led to waves of pogroms. Though pogroms started as early as 1821 in Odessa, Ukraine, these violent attacks didn't become widespread until Alexander III. This wave kicked off the beginning of the end for the Pale communities. Jews were once again made to be the scapegoat of the nation's problems. New laws reinstated restrictions where Jews could live and own land outside shtetls. Arrests, beatings, and deportations became daily occurrences, not just for the lower classes, but also for the middle class and in the Jewish intelligentsia. The first Russian revolution of the early 20th century failed to overthrow the Tsar, and this final period of the Tsarist system was particularly disastrous for the Jews. They were terrorized by as many as 284 pogroms, many of which were not only supported by, but often organized by the government. The violence resulted in over 50,000 Jews being murdered in the 4 years between 1903 and 1907. Most Jews realized that the end had come for Jewish life in Russia, and many who could moved. Around 2.5 million Jews emigrated from Russia between 1881 and 1914 to places like the United States, Western Europe, and what was known as the region of Palestine, the land of Israel. For many, it was to escape the pogroms. For others, it was a move towards a world of new opportunities and ideas away from the shtetl. The Pale of Settlement was officially abolished in 1917, and any remnant was destroyed in the Holocaust. Though the destiny of the Russian shtetl proved to be a tragic one, Jewish life inside was often rich and happy despite crushing obstacles. Innovations resulted in an enriched educational system for Judaism, personal growth, and revolutions in Torah study. Many of these changes have become essential aspects of how Judaism is lived today. The Russian persecution and isolation would ultimately strangle the shtetl way of life. But the ideologies, practices, traditions, and culture that emerged would outlast the Tsarist regimes that tried to destroy them.
Wow. You got to just think and be thankful, but be always aware that there are forces out there that would want to put us back in something like that again. It's hard to believe, well, but it truly is.
I know, but it's this fear that we're living in a small golden age, right? Because throughout the last 2,000 plus years, we've seen these small golden ages. Like there was a small golden age, you know, even in Morocco and Spain before the Spanish Inquisition, there was a small golden age in the Netherlands. There was a small golden age in Poland. There was a small golden age in Persia. There was a small golden age in different areas. Like, and then like this the tide shifts. And there's even in Europe, you know, with the whole Enlightenment in the 17, 1800s, which then turned into this rise of anti-Semitism into the early 1900s. It's very frightening.
It is. There's a prayer for the high holidays where we talk about the fact that there will always be a Haman, there will always be a Hitler, and we have to be vigilant to make sure that we keep them away, but there'll be people out there like that all the time.
Exactly.
Okay, we got to take a break. We are also going to focus on, coming up next, anti-Semitism in Britain, which we have talked about. It's really disturbing. We'll be back with that right after this. This is The Third Opinion.
Third Opinion will be right back. Just a reminder to visit our website, thirdopinionpodcast.com. While you're there, you can leave us a comment or suggestion, learn more about our hosts, and listen to podcasts you may have missed. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to the Third Opinion Podcast and on WKDW, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we have been talking about problems in Britain. In fact, last week when we did the top 10 worst anti-Semites?
Well, it was Simon Wiesenthal Center's top 10 anti-Semites for the year, or anti-Semitic organizations. BBC obviously topped the list. I think they were like number three or something. They were up there. The BBC has this horrible reputation. And one of the most recent was when that bus carrying a bunch of Jewish observers were going to a Hanukkah celebration, and the bus was stopped somewhere. And literally, there were all these people outside the bus that started attacking the people in the bus, throwing stuff at them, cursing at them, you know, like just attacking the Jews in the bus who were going to this Hanukkah celebration, you know, free Palestine, all this other crap, and just saying horrible things about the Jews in Israel. And the BBC, of course, in their coverage of it, is like, oh, well, the people in the bus were chanting anti-Muslim slurs, which is completely false. I mean, if people went back and listened to the
tapes,
the audio, there's none of that.
Right. So,
and it's like, and BBC just like couldn't report the truth. It's like, no, we're not going to report the truth. That somehow the Jews were causing these people to attack them while they were in the bus and those people are outside. But no, that's not what happened, BBC. So
no, and
you know,
as a matter of fact,
other issues this week too.
Well, yeah, Rabbi Y.Y. Rubenstein, who was a longtime contributor to the BBC, resigned. He said, "I can't work here anymore. They are so anti-Semitic." But the piece that we're going to play is from a actual journalist, and it was run on the BBC. Works for the BBC, but I'm sort of surprised they let it run. Maybe to balance off some of their other stuff. This is about the rising tide of anti-Semitism in Britain. It is very disturbing. Let's take a listen. Yeah.
I'm Tom, and I'm a BBC journalist who also happens to be British and Jewish. I'm proud of who I am, but the past year has been complicated and sometimes frightening.
Respect that. It's Jewish.
In the first 6 months of 2021, there was a record spike in anti-Semitism. From controversy around the Middle East to conspiracy theories and the toxic environment of social media, many Jewish people are questioning how safe it is to express who they are. I want to find out what's going on, and I'm starting in Burnley, where Ashley was the victim of an extreme example of anti-Semitism. In March 2020, Ashley was attacked by three men just outside his home. The assault took place in front of his mum.
They were going, well, that blue car is now, but it was a different colour car then, and started shouting, "Dirty Jew, look at that dirty Jew." And then one of them came under the driveway then and started attacking me. And I was full of blood, and I was still with the adrenaline pumping.
And I mean, how long were you dealing with the physical injuries? And
about 3-4 weeks.
And any mental injuries off the back of it?
PTSD. It took me a while to go back outside again.
Quite a lot of people in Burnley actually came to me and said, "Are you okay? Do you need anything?" Stuff like that. It was really heartwarming.
What does your Jewish identity mean to you?
Everything. Absolutely everything. It's my life, really.
And how does it make you feel that something you hold clearly so dear to you, something you love about yourself, is something that other people
hate,
use as a target?
It hurts me a lot, because end of the day, what we all want is just to live our lives in peace, Never going to happen, though.
So have things got worse for Jews in this country? To find out, I'm meeting up with Dave Rich, head of policy at a Jewish charity called the Community Security Trust. The CST gathers reports from members of the public and shares data with several police forces around the UK, keeping a record of how many anti-Semitic incidents take place each year. Recently, there's been a lot about anti-Semitic hate crime in the news. What is the latest report that you've produced?
Sadly, during the recent conflict in Israel and Gaza in May this year, we recorded over 600 anti-Semitic incidents in a one-month period, which is more than we've ever seen in a single month period since CST has been doing this work, which is since 1984. One of the things that was really different and quite worrying this time around was the number of anti-Semitic incidents reported to us from schools and from universities. Around one in four of all the incidents we recorded during that month of the conflict happened in an educational setting. The impact on the young people who experience that anti-Semitism is awful.
I also wanted to ask Dave if he could define when legitimate criticism of the Israeli government lapses into outright anti-Semitism.
So if someone walks down Oxford Street waving a Palestinian flag and shouting Free Palestine, we would never consider that anti-Semitic. It's obviously not. But if someone walks past a synagogue or walks through a heavily Jewish neighbourhood shouting Free Palestine at the Jewish people on the street in order to harass them and upset them, it takes on a completely different meaning, and that's when you're seeing Jewish people being targeted.
Anti-Semitism at schools and unis is complicated, and it's often tied to strong views about one tiny but hugely contentious place, Israel. At Bristol University, a professor allegedly made comments about Israel which Jewish students say made them feel targeted. I'm meeting a student who tackled the situation head on.
Broadly then, what were the controversial comments that he was making? What was it all about?
Yeah, so the key stuff was definitely the Jewish society is pawns to the Israeli state, because it was implying that sort of a bunch of students, like under 18-year-olds at Bristol, were manufacturing complaints of anti-Semitism to get rid of him.
So what effect did his statements have on Jewish students at the university?
A lot of students are very concerned about being in his class. I think it also just created a generally quite hostile environment at Bristol Uni. So when I started the petition, I got an email from the Electronic Intifada, who are a news blog, and they wrote an article about me, examples of the comments I received. I was told to go die, Zionist scum, dirty Zio. I've never received just the sheer volume of comments and anti-Semitism before. So it just did feel quite overwhelming just to have that number of people know who I was, possibly know where I go to uni, possibly know where I live.
David Miller denies he was anti-Semitic. Nonetheless, in October, after a two-year investigation, he was sacked by Bristol University. David Miller's appealing against his dismissal, and I reached out to him for a response to the allegations, but didn't receive a reply. The situation highlights just how complicated conversations around Israel can be. And that's true even among Jewish families. I didn't grow up in a particularly religious home, but my parents have always made me feel proud about being Jewish. I invited them over for lunch to hear their points of view. Hello, Mum. Come in.
Hello.
Hello. Come in. I'm going out with you.
Hello.
You might recognise these mums. I've had times when you've called me and told me that you feel frightened. What is it that specifically you feel frightened of?
You can't help but get distressed when people's views about a political situation bleed into the way they treat people in this country who are in no way responsible for that situation and whose views about that situation you can't possibly know. When you're Jewish and you begin to see that sort of prejudice, you think, we know what this is about. We've been here many, many times before.
I don't feel personally threatened. I think this is a very balanced society, and I think the majority of people would not buy into those kind of views. I wouldn't equate it with the sort of anti-Semitism that existed in the 19th century in Russia or
in the 1930s
in Germany. I just don't think that the British society could actually go there, because the majority of people here are not anti-Semitic. So I don't feel personally under threat.
It's kind of interesting that Mum feels it more keenly, but you feel it less keenly,
when you're the one whose history, personal family history, bears more scars of what happened in the 20th century, more of your family, bluntly, were killed.
Yeah, I've never met any of my grandparents, all died in concentration camps. I had an uncle and a cousin that died in concentration camps that I never knew. But kind of, I come from a family where we put it behind us.
How fundamental is your Jewishness to who you are?
In my public life, I think of myself as British. In my private life, I'm Jewish. I'm very strongly Jewish, and I think a lot of my ethics are very Jewish. Instinctively, I think Jewish people, as a minority, identify with other minorities. I think that will be one of the terrible things that might be the outcome of the rise in anti-Semitism, that we might become more inward-looking, whereas I think it's part of our ethics to identify with other people and do whatever we can to support them.
Their difference of opinion actually demonstrates an important point. Jews aren't some monolithic group who think or feel or even look the same way. I'm meeting Nadine, who's a black Jewish woman. I first heard about her last year when she called out anti-Semitism on Twitter.
It just demonstrated the complexities of what it can be like being a Jewish black person. It's a lot easier to recognise if someone calls me the N-word or someone says something derogatory about my skin colour to know that it's racist versus, you know, if someone makes a comment like, oh, you know, Jews run the media. It's not as overt, but I also think they manifest themselves differently. I think, you know, in the 21st century, you don't have the kind of structural, socioeconomic, intergenerational inequality that you see within black communities, as in the same in the Jewish community. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the threat levels aren't serious. I just don't think people have a very solid understanding of what anti-Semitism is, because I just don't think we're taught about it very well.
So we're on the way to meet a young lady who works as a nurse in an East London hospital. And back in May, during the flare-up of the conflict, she had a fairly unpleasant experience while she was at work. And I think what happened to her is quite a good demonstration of how complicated things can be when Israel is in the news and how that affects Jewish people living even in the UK.
Hello, how are you? I was downstairs in the prayer room praying the afternoon service, and then made my way back upstairs to the 8th floor. Two guys were in the lift, and I just see them look at me, and one of them turns to me and said, "So do you not believe in free Palestine? How can they let someone who comes from people who kill innocent children work here?" And I'm happy that he like stumbled and fumbled, because by the time he said that to me, the doors opened and I managed to get out. It all happened very quickly. Obviously, it's petrifying. I don't think that whatever's going on in the world in terms of the fighting and the, you know, do you believe in this side, do you believe in that side, that shouldn't affect anyone's medical care that's happening. And I would never use someone's beliefs or religion or ethnicity or anything to decide how I'm going to treat them.
Many Jews do feel an affinity with Israel, but for some, it's more complicated. Francesca is part of a group of British Jewish activists who campaign against the actions of the Israeli government.
Yes, we do get a lot of backlash from more right-wing sort of people and organisations. Our feeling is that if we're ruffling feathers, it kind of means that we are putting out a good and kind of challenging message that makes people think.
Have you had any anti-Semitism come at you because of Israel?
Yeah, I think often people who speak out against the occupation are seen as the good Jew and are kind of posed as, it's like people want to grill you to understand if you're anti-occupation before kind of feeling like they can accept you as a Jewish person. In left-wing circles specifically, but also we do have a responsibility as Jewish people to speak up against atrocities in the world. Doesn't mean that we should be held responsible for it as diaspora Jews, but I think speaking out against it is important.
Francesca spoke about being held to account over what happens in Israel in a way that she found problematic. I want to speak directly to someone whose activism leads to accusations of anti-Semitism. So I'm meeting up with two YouTubers. Back in May, they drove to a Jewish community in London and filmed themselves challenging Jewish people on the street. One of their videos, titled "Muslims Confront Radical Israelis," all in caps, has racked up almost 300,000 views.
According to the definition of the British government, which on anti-Semitism, which was published in 2016, one of the definitions of anti-Semitism is when you hold Jewish people responsible for the actions of the Israeli government. And I think doing that conflation puts at risk people being anti-Semitic. And so it's very important that if someone is an apologist for Israel or for Zionism, that that should be outlined and delineated or otherwise completely separated from Jewishness.
Isn't the title of your video "Muslims Confront Radical Israelis"?
Yes.
And isn't that doing exactly what you're saying shouldn't be done? Conflating a group of Jewish people in Britain and calling them Israelis?
I mean, if someone identifies as an Israeli supporter, an apologist, or a pro-Zionist, right, then they have already shown their cards. What we're saying is that there is a difference between Israeli discourse or pro-Israeli discourse. When we say that, we mean those who are sympathetic or apologetic to the policies of the Israeli government, the policies of blockade, the policies of settlement. If we decide to oppose these policies, okay, that should never be conflated with anti-Jewishism.
But I think specifically that video did strike me as problematic in lots of ways. And I think specifically the title of the video, "Muslims Confront Radical Israelis," do you not see how that is problematic in itself?
No, they are radical Israelis.
And do you think there's a different way of communicating?
What I mean is, you're objecting to the term radical Israeli. Are there such things as radical Iranians? Are there such things as radical Koreans?
No, but I'm objecting to radical Israelis because you went to speak to just some, you know, fairly religious Jewish people who are British people. They are certainly, you definitely don't know if they're Israelis.
No. They identified as such. And not only that.
I didn't see a single person in that video identify themselves as an Israeli.
There was more than one video.
So I definitely think that helping people understand one another better is an important part of dealing with prejudice. But like Nadine said, anti-Semitism is something a lot of people don't really understand. Sometimes anti-Semitism is really easy to recognise. It's those mad conspiracy theories about world domination, or it's someone being beaten up simply for who they are. When we're in a situation where discrimination is normalised and people who say they feel unsafe aren't being listened to, well, that's something I don't think any of us should be willing to accept.
I don't know what to say. It's just it's just upsetting that so many people, you know, but when you think that Jeremy Corbyn, who was running for president, was a blatant anti-Semite, and he could have been elected as the prime minister of Britain.
That's frightening. I'm grateful that the people of Britain rose up and stood against Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, it was really actually quite extraordinary, the outcry, even within the Labour Party, people saying, no, enough is enough. Basta, I think is how you say it in Spanish. Basta, enough is enough. You know, and I think, you know, it's interesting the BBC is playing this, because in many ways BBC is a proponent of a lot of the anti-Semitic rhetoric in Britain, and continue to promote, you know, untruths and some of the lies about Israel and the whole thing. But I I'm glad they played the piece. It's very disturbing, as we know. But it's that underlying anti-Semitism. I don't think it ever went away. It didn't go away. There was like I always say, there was like this golden age post World War II, and I think, you know, as we've seen this global rise in Europe and in Latin America now, and North America, this open, like, it's just become, you know, as we've talked about even with CNN, I mean, this open anti-Semitism, even in mainstream media, and people just look the other way. It's like, oh, well, yeah, you know, the Jews. Yeah.
No, that is very true. We have to speak up. We must speak up. We cannot just turn our heads and say, well, it's okay, you know. We have to speak up and speak out and say it's wrong. Well, here's the shift. COVID in Israel, COVID everywhere. They're up to 17,000 cases now, and in a small country, that is a lot. But surprisingly, they're going to let U.S. visitors back into Israel despite the rise in COVID. First time since November, I guess, right? Isn't that when?
When Omicron first began to hit, that, you know, Israel sort of had certain travel restrictions. So a lot of people from the States and from other places have been like screaming, like, you know, we got to come back. We want to go to Israel. So they're opening it back up. I think, again, because it is a small country, you know, at that point, no one really knew what Omicron would be. I mean, obviously it spreads like wildfire, but the symptoms are, you know, are substantially less severe. And
particularly if you're vaccinated,
I'll make the pitch for
vaccination. And I'll just say I went to a funeral a couple of weeks ago at our synagogue with a friend of mine who is a devout anti-vaxxer at 63. He died of COVID. Just, you know, left two kids, a wife, and bright guy. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to say. It makes me sad. It makes me angry. On a happier note, New York has a new mayor, Eric Adams.
Woohoo! And I love Eric Adams.
So do the Orthodox Jews in Brooklyn. You know,
he's from Brooklyn. You know, Eric Adams has had countless roles here politically in Brooklyn. And so because that, and like Brooklyn, there's multiple neighborhoods within, you know, Williamsburg, Briar Park, Flatbush, Crown Heights, where you have a variety of different Orthodox Jewish communities. And he's, you know, whether from the state legislature and different roles, he's held different, and as well as being a former cop, he's held a lot of different elected roles. And because of that, specifically in Brooklyn, you know, that's where most of the Orthodox Jews live. And so he has those relationships, very deep ties. You know, even as we talked about a couple of weeks ago during Hanukkah, he happened to be in Ghana, made sure that he went to the only Chabad in Ghana for the menorah lighting. I mean, come on. Right. I mean, the guy's like, you know, and not only that, but he changed the timing of his swearing-in ceremony as the new mayor of New York City to make sure that it fell after Shabbat so that his friends who did observe Shabbat could go to his swearing-in ceremony.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's honoring.
Yeah, no, I think... And Bill de Blasio did not necessarily have a great relationship with the Jewish community. Is that fair to say?
I would say Bill de Blasio was no friend of the Jewish community in New York City.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff that would just come out of his mouth and just, you know, it was just shocking sometimes. I think we're all very glad Bill de Blasio is no longer the mayor of New York. Good riddance is what I could say.
He's going to run for governor now. He hasn't quite announced it, but he's going to run.
When you think of the talk show host who was doing the New Year's Eve party celebration with Anderson Cooper, I forgot his name, but he was hilarious. And he had a little bit too much to drink. So after midnight, he was like, the best thing, you know, he's going on and on about Bill de Blasio being gone. Like, the people in New York City have, like, had it with Bill de Blasio. So the fact that he would run for governor would surprise me, because I think even the people who initially voted for him wouldn't vote for him again. So I don't really know what he's thinking about there. But that's a whole other story.
That is a whole other. But anyway, it's good. I think that Eric Adams is going to be good for the Jewish community in New York.
So,
I mean, you know, from a political standpoint, it makes sense. There are so many Jewish families in New York.
Yes.
I mean, even if you don't believe it, just from a political standpoint, it just makes a lot of sense. But, you know, some people are thick-headed. One other bad thing I did want to mention, I should have mentioned at the top when we were talking about anti-Semitism. Did you see the tally of anti-Semitic attacks against Jews in Israel in 2021, 6,633 terror attacks in 2021, shootings, bombings, Molotov stabbings. That's like, it's like 18 a day.
It was a crazy number.
Yeah.
I mean, so just, you know, this is Jews being attacked in Israel. And I think that, you know, that to me, I mean, this year was a very difficult year, especially because obviously the conflict that then occurred in May, it just caused those terror attacks to skyrocket. Hamas obviously is doing, Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, who's over in the Palestinian Authority, you know, they say things to throw fuel on the fire and to get people inflamed and go out and commit these attacks. And that's what's so upsetting about it. And then you get innocent people, you know, hurting other innocent people. I just, they're so brainwashed, and it's just sad. I think for me, the other disturbing story, so if you're a Harry Potter fan, sorry.
Yeah, no, I know. Go ahead.
Come on. Yeah, Emma Watson. And, you know, again, another Brit. So Emma Watson, you know, from the woke, you know, Hollywood world in Britain, you know, obviously from Harry Potter fame. You know, she, this week there was a tweet that was put out. It was specifically by a follower, you know, a pro-Palestinian follower who is known for posting, you know, anti-Israel tweets, the organization. So she retweeted a tweet, and then she went on, and the tweet had this whole solidarity quote and what solidarity is. And it says, solidarity involves commitment and work as well as recognition that even if we don't have the same feelings or the same lives, we have the same bodies, we do live on common ground. Well, okay, can I just say this? Let's not put it lightly. The tweet from the organization she was retweeting is known to be anti-Semitic. And two, most importantly, it has this picture that has solidarity is a verb, but then it's with all these people holding Free Palestine signs. One says, you know, hands off Jerusalem. I think another one says, you know, F Israel. There's like a bunch of, like, one of the signs, and I don't think you've seen on this one tweet, says, from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free. I mean, it's clearly an anti-Israel.
Yeah.
And like she's promoting the fact that Israel doesn't have a right to exist.
Well, you know,
to her 64 million followers on Twitter. And that's a problem.
It's a major problem. And then there's always, as long as we're on the Harry Potter thing, there was pushback this week about one of J.K. Rowling's characters who looked like a
the bankers.
Yeah, even John Stewart came out and said that was maybe sort of anti-Semitic. So I just
the caricatures, right? The caricatures they look like, you know, they had the traditional hooked noses, and of course they're the bankers, and then, you know, everybody was to say that Jews run the world and the banks and the money. So, you know, the concern there, obviously, you know, for those of you know the traditional anti-Semitic trope that Jews run the world, we run all the money, we're the bankers, we control all the world's finances. So, you know, the Jews with the hook noses, and of course the J.K. Rowling characters, these little goblins that ran the banks, they all had like the big, you know, hook noses. And yeah, you know, there's a question there, is that like a classic anti-Semitic trope? You know, did she do that intentional? I don't know.
Whether it was intentional or not, it just doesn't look right. But you know what that music means, Laureen? We are out of time. Listen, thank you so much for listening to us. We are available wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends if you liked the show. If you didn't, don't tell your friends. And we're also, of course, on WKDW. And we appreciate you being with us. This is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Laureen Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast for this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.